Cratylus, a dialogue of Socrates with Hermogenes and Cratylus.
Shall we bring the question to Socrates here?
If you like.
Socrates, Cratylus here says that there is a correctness of names belonging to each thing by nature, and that a name is not whatever people agree to call a thing, uttering some fragment of their own speech, but that there is a certain correctness in names, the same for Greeks and for foreigners alike. So I asked him whether Cratylus is truly his name, and he agreed that it is. And what about Socrates? I said. Socrates, he said. Then isn't this also the name that belongs to every other person, whatever we call each of them? But he said, no, not Hermogenes for you, not even if everyone in the world called you that. And when I question him and press him to say what in the world he means, he explains nothing, and he's being ironic with me, pretending to have some private thought of his own about the matter, as if he knew, which, if he cared to state it plainly, would make even me agree and say the same things he says. So if you can somehow make sense of Cratylus's oracle, I'd be glad to hear it. Or rather, I'd be even happier to learn from you yourself what you think about the correctness of names, if you're willing.
Hermogenes, son of Hipponicus, there's an old saying that fine things are hard to learn, and the study of names turns out to be no small thing. Now if I had already heard Prodicus's 50-drachma lecture, which he says gives its hearer a complete education on the subject, nothing would stop you from knowing the truth about the correctness of names right away. But as it is, I haven't heard that one, only the 1-drachma version. So I don't know how the truth stands on such matters, but I'm ready to look into it together with you and Cratylus. As for his denying that Hermogenes is truly your name, I suspect he's teasing you, since he probably thinks you're always failing to acquire the wealth you're after. But as I was just saying, such things are hard to know, and we should pool our resources and examine whether the matter stands as you say or as Cratylus says. Perhaps you're saying something, Hermogenes. Let's look into it. Whatever anyone calls a thing, is that its name?
I think so.
Whether a private person calls it that, or a whole city?
I say yes.
Well then, if I call some existing thing something, say what we now call man, if I address that as horse, and what we now call horse as man, will the same thing publicly be named man but privately horse, and privately man but publicly horse? Is that what you're saying?
I think so.
Now tell me this. Do you speak of things being said truly and falsely?
I do.
So there would be a true statement and a false one?
Certainly.
And the one that says what is, as it is true, while the one that says it as it is not is false?
Yes.
So it's possible in speech to say both what is and what is not?
Certainly.
A true statement, then, is it true as a whole while its parts are not true?
No, the parts too.
Are the large parts true, and the small ones not, or all of them?
All, I think.
Is there any part of a statement smaller than a name?
No, that's the smallest.
So this too, a name, is said to belong to the true statement?
Yes.
True as you say?
Yes.
And the part of the false statement isn't false?
It is, I say.
So it's possible for a name to be spoken falsely and truly, if a statement can be?
How could it not?
So whatever each person says is the name of a thing, that is its name for that person?
Yes.
And however many names each person says a thing has, will it have that many, whenever he says so?
Yes, Socrates, because I don't have any other correctness for a name than this, that it's one thing for me to call each thing whatever name I've assigned it, and another thing for you, whatever you in turn assign. And this is how I see it with cities too, each having its own names privately set on the same things, and Greeks differing from other Greeks, and Greeks differing from foreigners.
Well then, let's see, Hermogenes, whether things themselves seem to you to stand this way too, that their being is private to each person, as Protagoras used to say, claiming that man is the measure of all things, meaning that whatever things appear to me to be, such they are for me, and whatever they appear to you to be, such they are for you. Or does it seem to you that they have some fixed stability of their own being?
There was a time, Socrates, when I was at a loss and was carried along to what Protagoras says, but it doesn't altogether seem right to me.
What then? Have you been carried so far as to think there's no such thing as a wicked man?
No, by Zeus, but I've often had the experience of thinking some men quite wicked, and a good many of them.
What then, have quite good men, never seemed to you to exist?
Very few.
But some have seemed so.
Yes.
How do you classify this, then? Would it be that the quite good are quite wise, and the quite wicked quite foolish?
That's how it seems to me.
Is it possible, then, if Protagoras spoke truly and this is the truth, that whatever seems to each person to be so, is so, that some of us are wise and others foolish?
No, indeed.
And this, I imagine, seems quite right to you. Since wisdom and foolishness exist, it's not really possible for Protagoras to be speaking the truth. For surely neither of two people would in truth be wiser than the other, if whatever seems true to each person is going to be true.
That's so.
But surely you don't think, following Euthydemus either, that all things are alike for everyone at once and always. For then there wouldn't be good people and wicked ones in this way, if virtue and vice were alike for everyone always.
What you say is true.
So if things aren't alike for everyone at once and always, nor is each existing thing private to each person, then it's clear that things themselves have some fixed being of their own, not in relation to us, nor dragged up and down by our imagining, but existing by themselves in relation to their own being, in whatever way they naturally are.
That's how it seems to me, Socrates.
Would things themselves, then, be so by nature, while actions concerning them are not the same way? Or aren't actions too one class of existing things?
Certainly they are too.
Then actions too are performed according to their own nature, not according to our opinion. For instance, if we undertake to cut something, should we cut it however we wish, and with whatever we wish, or if we wish to cut each thing according to nature, according to what cutting and being cut naturally are, and with what is natural for it, will we cut successfully and accomplish something and do it correctly, whereas if we go against nature we'll fail and accomplish nothing?
That's how it seems to me.
And if we undertake to burn something, shouldn't we burn it not according to every opinion, but according to the right one? And this is the way in which each thing naturally is burned and burns, and with what is natural for it.
That's so.
And isn't it the same with everything else?
Certainly.
Then isn't speaking too one of the actions?
Yes.
So will a person speak correctly by speaking however it seems to him things should be spoken? Or will he, if he speaks in the way things naturally are to be said and to say, and with what they're naturally said with, accomplish something and actually say something, whereas otherwise he'll fail and accomplish nothing?
It seems to me to be as you say.
So isn't naming a part of speaking? For people speak statements, I take it, by naming things within them.
Certainly.
So isn't naming also a kind of action, if speaking was indeed a kind of action concerning things?
Yes.
And actions turned out for us to not be relative to us, but to have some nature of their own.
That's so.
So we must name things in the way it's natural for things to be named and to name, and with what's natural for it, not however we might wish, if anything we said before is to be consistent, and in that way we'll accomplish something and be naming, but not otherwise.
It appears so to me.
Come then, what needed cutting, we say, needed to be cut with something.
Yes.
And what needed weaving needed to be woven with something. And what needed boring needed to be bored with something.
Certainly.
And what needed naming needed to be named with something.
That's so.
What was that thing one needed to bore with?
An auger.
And to weave with?
A shuttle.
And to name with?
A name.
Well said. So a name, too, is a kind of instrument.
Certainly.
Now if I asked, what sort of instrument is a shuttle? Isn't it the thing we weave with?
Yes.
And when we weave, what do? Don't we separate out the warp and weft threads that were tangled together?
Yes.
And could you say the same sort of thing about an auger and about the others?
Certainly.
Can you say the same sort of thing about a name, too? When we name with a name, which is an instrument, what do?
I can't say.
Don't we teach one another something, and separate out things according to how they really are?
Certainly.
A name, then, is a kind of instrument for teaching, and for separating out being, just as a shuttle is for separating out a woven fabric.
Yes.
And a shuttle is an instrument for weaving.
Of course.
So a weaver will use a shuttle well, and using it well means using it as a weaver would. And a teacher will use a name well, and using it well means using it as a teacher would.
Yes.
Whose work, then, will the weaver be using well when he uses the shuttle?
The carpenter's.
Is every man a carpenter, or the one who has the craft?
The one who has the craft.
And whose work will the borer be using well when he uses the auger?
The smith.
Is every man a smith, or the one who has the craft?
The one who has the craft.
Very well. And whose work will the teacher be using when he uses a name?
That, too, I can't say.
Can't you say this either, who hands down to us the names we use?
No, indeed.
Doesn't it seem to you that it's the law that hands them down?
It seems so.
So the teacher will be using the work of a lawgiver when he uses a name?
I think so.
Does it seem to you that every man is a lawgiver, or only the one who has the craft? So it isn't every man, Hermogenes, who can assign a name, but only a certain craftsman of names. And this, it seems, is the lawgiver, who is the rarest of craftsmen among men.
So it seems.
Come then, consider what the lawgiver looks to when he assigns names. Go back to what we said before. What does the carpenter look to when he makes a shuttle? Isn't it something naturally suited for the work of weaving?
Certainly.
And if his shuttle breaks while he's making one, will he make another by looking at the broken one, or at that same form which he was looking at when he made the one that broke?
At that form, I should think.
Then wouldn't we most rightly call that very thing what a shuttle is?
I should think so.
So whenever he needs to make a shuttle for a fine cloak or a coarse one, for linen or wool or whatever, all of them must have the form of shuttle, but each must be given whatever shape is naturally best suited to its particular job.
Yes.
And the same holds for every other tool. Once you've discovered the tool naturally suited to each task, you must render it in whatever material you're working with, not however you yourself happen to want, but however it's naturally suited to be. It seems the craftsman must know how to put the naturally suited form of drill into the iron.
Certainly.
And the naturally suited form of shuttle into the wood.
That's so.
Because it seems, Each kind of fabric naturally calls for its own kind of shuttle, and so with everything else.
Yes.
Well then, my good man, mustn't the lawgiver also know how to put into sounds and syllables the name naturally suited to each thing? Must he not make and assign all names looking to what a name itself is, if he's going to be an authoritative namer? And if different lawgivers don't put it into the same syllables, that needn't trouble us. No more than every blacksmith puts the same form into the same iron, though he's making the same tool for the same purpose. As long as he renders the same form, the tool is correct whether it's made of different iron, and whether it's made here or among foreigners. Isn't that so?
Certainly.
So won't you likewise judge that the lawgiver here and the lawgiver among foreigners, as long as he renders the form of name appropriate to each thing in whatever syllables, is no worse a lawgiver than one anywhere else?
Certainly.
Then who is to know whether the appropriate form of shuttle lies in a given piece of wood, the one who made it, the carpenter, or the one who will use it, the weaver?
More likely the one who will use it, Socrates.
And who is it that will use the lyre maker's work? Isn't it the one who would know best how to oversee its making, and who would know, once it's made, whether it's well made or not?
Certainly.
Who is that?
The lyre player.
And who oversees the shipwright's work?
The pilot.
And who would oversee the lawgiver's work best, and judge it once done, both here and among foreigners? Isn't it the one who will use it?
Yes.
And isn't this the one who knows how to ask questions?
Certainly.
And the same one knows how to answer them too?
Yes.
And the one who knows how to ask and answer, do you call him anything but a dialectician?
No, that's just what I call him.
So it's the carpenter's job to make a rudder, under the pilot's oversight, if the rudder is to be a good one.
So it appears.
And it's the lawgiver's job, it seems, to make a name under the oversight of a dialectician, if names are to be well assigned.
That's so.
So it's likely, Hermogenes, that assigning names is no trivial matter, as you think, nor a task for trivial men or just anyone. And Cratylus speaks the truth when he says names belong to things by nature, and that not everyone is a craftsman of names, but only the one who keeps his eye on the name that belongs to each thing by nature, and who can render its form in letters and syllables.
I don't see how to oppose what you're saying, Socrates. Still, it isn't easy to be persuaded so suddenly. I think I'd be won over more readily if you showed me what this natural correctness of names actually is that you're talking about.
My dear Hermogenes, I'm not talking about any correctness at all. You've forgotten what I said just a little earlier, that I didn't know, but would look into it together with you. But now, as we've been examining it, you and I, this much already appears clearer than before, that a name has some natural correctness, and that not just anyone knows how to assign it well to any given thing. Isn't that so?
Certainly.
Then the next thing to look for, if you really want to know, is what exactly this correctness is.
Well, I certainly do want to know.
Then consider it.
How should I go about it?
The most correct way to inquire, my friend, is together with those who know, paying them fees and showing them gratitude. These are the sophists, the very men your brother Callias paid a great deal of money to and is thought wise for it. But since you're not master of your father's estate, you should press your brother and beg him to teach you the correctness he learned from Protagoras on such matters.
It would be strange of me to make that request, Socrates, when I reject Protagoras's truth altogether, yet welcome what was said on the basis of such a truth as if it were worth something.
Well, if that doesn't suit you either, you should learn from Homer and the other poets.
And what does Homer say about names, Socrates, and where?
In many places, but the grandest and finest are where he distinguishes, for the same things, the names men use from the names the gods use. Or don't you think he says something great and remarkable there about the correctness of names? For clearly the gods call things by their correct names, the ones that belong to them by nature, or don't you think so?
I'm quite sure that if they do call them anything, they call them correctly. But what examples do you mean?
Don't you know that concerning the river in Troy that fought single-handed with Hephaestus, he says the gods call it Xanthus, but men call it Scamander?
I do.
Well then, don't you think it's a solemn thing to know why it's actually correct to call that river Xanthus rather than Scamander? Or if you like, take the bird he says. The gods call it Chalkis, but men call it Chimindes. Do you think it's a trivial lesson to learn how much more correct it is for that same bird to be called Chalkis than Chimindes? Or Batia and Myrine, and many other such examples from this poet and from others. But perhaps those are too big a task for you and me to work out. The names Scamandrius and Astyanax, though, are easier and more human to examine, I think. The names he says belong to Hector's son, what correctness he means by them. You know the verses I mean, of course.
Certainly.
Then which do you think Homer considered the more correct name for the boy, Astyanax or Scamandrius?
I can't say.
Consider it this way. If someone asked you whether you think the wiser people or the more foolish give more correct names, what would you say?
Clearly the wiser, I'd say.
And in cities, do you think women as a class are wiser than men?
The men.
Then you know that Homer says Hector's child was called Astyanax by the Trojans, while Scamandrius was clearly the name used by the women, since the men called him Astyanax.
So it seems.
And didn't Homer also consider the Trojans wiser than their women?
I think he did.
So he thought Astyanax the more correct name for the boy than Scamandrius.
So it appears.
Let's consider why. Doesn't he himself give us the best guide to the reason? For he says, "For he alone defended their city and its long walls." For this reason, it seems, it's correct to call the son of the protector Astyanax lord of the city, since it was that very city his father was protecting, as Homer says.
So it seems to me.
But why exactly? I don't yet understand it myself, Hermogenes, do you?
No, by Zeus, I don't either.
But tell me, my good man, did Homer himself assign the name to Hector too?
Why do you ask?
Because it seems to me that this name too is something like Astyanax, and both names look Greek. For Anax, Lord, and Hector are pretty much the same in meaning. Both are royal names. For whatever a man is Lord Anax of, he is surely also Hector, Hector of, clearly he holds it, possesses it, and has it. Or do you think I'm talking nonsense, and merely imagine I've caught hold of some trace of Homer's view on the correctness of names?
No, by Zeus. I don't think it's nonsense. I think you really have caught hold of something.
It's only right, it seems to me, to call the offspring of a lion, and the offspring of a horse. I don't mean if some freak is born from a horse unlike a horse. I mean whatever is naturally the offspring of that kind. If a horse should, contrary to nature, bear the offspring of an ox, we shouldn't call it a foal but a calf. And if what's born isn't the natural offspring of a human being, I don't think it should be called human, but whatever it actually is. The same goes for trees and everything else, or don't you agree?
I agree.
Good, watch me, in case I somehow trick you along the way. By the same reasoning, if some offspring comes from a king, it should be called king. It makes no difference if the same meaning is expressed in different syllables, nor does it matter if a letter is added or taken away, so long as the being of the thing signified by the name still holds firm.
What do you mean by that?
Nothing complicated. You know that we speak the names of the letters, not the letters themselves, except for four, E, U, O, and Olong. For the rest, both vowels and consonants, we speak them by adding other letters around them, making them into names. But as long as we build in the power that belongs to the letter, it's correct to call it by the name that will make it clear to us. Take beta, for instance. You see that adding eta, tau, and alpha caused no harm. It didn't prevent the whole name from making clear the nature of that letter, in the way the lawgiver intended. So skillfully was it arranged to assign names to the letters.
I think you're right.
And doesn't the same reasoning apply to a king? A king will in time be born of a king, a good man of a good man, a beautiful one of a beautiful one, and so on for everything else, each kind producing another offspring of the same sort, unless some monstrosity occurs. So the same names must be applied. But it's possible to vary them with different syllables, so that someone unfamiliar with the matter might think things that are really the same are different from one another. Just as, to us, doctors' medicines look different when they're dressed up with colors and smells, though they're really the same, while to the doctor, who examines the medicine's actual power, they look the same, and he isn't thrown off by what's added to them. In the same way, I suppose, someone who understands names looks at their power and isn't thrown off if some letter is added or moved or taken away, or even if the name's power resides in entirely different letters. Take what we were just saying. Astyanax and Hector share no letters except the tau, and yet they mean the same thing. And Archepolis, what does it share letter-wise? Yet it signifies the very same thing. And there are many other names that signify nothing but king, and others again that mean general, like Agis and Polemarchus and Eupolmus, and others that belong to medicine, Iatrochles and Assesimbratus, and we could probably find plenty more that disagree in syllables and letters but say the same thing in their power. Does it appear so or not?
It certainly does.
So to things born according to nature, the same names must be assigned.
Certainly.
But what about things contrary to nature, that turn out as a kind of monstrosity? For instance, when an impious man is born from a good and God-fearing man, isn't it just as in the earlier cases, where if a horse produces the offspring of an ox, it shouldn't, I take it, get the name of its begetter, but of the kind it belongs to?
Certainly.
And so to the impious man born of the pious one, the name of his own kind must be given.
That's so.
Not Theophilus, it seems, nor Nesithius, nor anything of that sort. But a name meaning the opposite of these, provided the names hit their proper correctness.
Absolutely, Socrates.
Just as Orestes II, Hermogenes, seems likely to have the right name, whether it was chance that gave it to him or some poet, pointing, by that name, to the beastly and wild and mountain-like side of his nature.
So it appears, Socrates.
And his father's name, too, seems to fit nature.
It appears so.
For Agamemnon seems to be the sort of man who, once he'd resolved on something, would labor at it and hold out to the end, sticking to what he decided out of virtue. The proof of this is his staying at Troy through all that suffering and endurance. So this name Agamemnon signals that this man is admirable, Agastos, for his persistence, Epimon. And perhaps Atreus too is correctly named. For the murder of Chrysippus and the savage things he did to Thyestes, all of these are ruinous and harmful atera to virtue. So the meaning of this name is bent a little to one side and disguised, so that it doesn't reveal the man's nature to everyone. But to those with adequate understanding of names, it shows plainly enough what Atreus means. For by unyielding, Aderes, and by unflinching, Atrestos, and by destructive, Aderin, the name is rightly given to him in every way. And it seems to me that Pelops' name too fits him fittingly. For this name signifies one who sees only what is near Pellas, and is worthy of that title.
How so?
Well, it's said of that man, in the murder of Metellus, that he was unable to plan ahead or foresee any of the distant consequences for his whole line, how much misfortune he was filling it with, seeing only what was near and immediate, and that's what near means, when he was eager to win the marriage of Hippodamia by any means at all. And as for Tantalus, everyone would agree his name was rightly and naturally given, if the stories told about him are true.
What stories are those?
The many terrible misfortunes that came upon him while he still lived, which ended in the total overthrow of his homeland, and then after his death, the famous stone balanced Talentea over his head in Hades, how well it harmonizes with his name. And it's exactly as if someone, wanting to call him most wretched, Talentados but hiding what he meant, said Tantalus instead. It seems some such thing is what chance contrived for him in giving him this name and this reputation. And it appears to me that his father, as he's called, Zeus, has a name given most beautifully, though it isn't easy to grasp. For the name of Zeus is really like a whole sentence, which we split into two, and some of us use one part, some the other. Some say Xena, others Dia, and put together into one they reveal the god's nature, which we say a name ought to be able to do. For there is no one, for us or for anyone else, more responsible for life than the ruler and king of all things. So it turns out this god is rightly named, this being through whom living always belongs to all living things. The name, though one, has been split in two, as I say, into Dia and Xena. Now if you heard suddenly that he's the son of Cronus, you might think that an insult, but it's reasonable that Zeus should be the offspring of some great intellect. For Cronus signifies not a child, but the purity and unsulliedness of his mind, Corin. And this Cronus, so the story goes, is the son of Uranus, and the upward gaze is rightly called by this name Aurania, looking at things above, and that Hermogenes is exactly where the astronomers say pure mind comes from, and so heaven, Auranos, has the right name too. If I remembered Hesiod's genealogy, and which still earlier ancestors he names before these, I wouldn't stop going through how correctly their names too are given, until I'd tested this wisdom that has suddenly fallen upon me from I don't know where just now, to see what it will do, whether it will give out or not.
Yes, indeed, Socrates, you really do seem to me like one of those who suddenly, like the inspired, start prophesying.
And I do blame it, Hermogenes, mostly on having caught it from Euthyphro of Prospalta. I was with him a great deal since early this morning, lending him my ears. It seems that in his inspired state, he's not only filled my ears with this divine wisdom, but has taken hold of my soul as well. So I think we ought to do this. For today, let's make use of it and go on examining the rest about names. But tomorrow, if you all agree, we'll perform a rite of banishment on it and get purified, once we find someone skilled at purifying such things, whether some priest or some sophist.
Well, I agree. I'd be very glad to hear the rest about names.
Then that's what we should do. Where do you want us to begin our inquiry, now that we've stepped into a kind of pattern, so we can see whether the names themselves will bear witness for us that they aren't simply assigned at random in each case, but have some correctness? Now, the names given to heroes and to men might well deceive us, for many of them are given after their ancestors' names, which doesn't fit some of them at all, as we said at the start. And many are given as a kind of wish, like Eutychides and Sosias and Theophilus and plenty of others. So I think we should leave such names aside. It's much more likely we'll find the correctly given names among things that always exist and are so by nature. For it's there above all that the giving of names ought to have been done with care, though perhaps some of them were even established by a power more divine than that of men.
You seem to me to be speaking well, Socrates.
Isn't it right, then, to start from the gods, examining how it is that this very name, gods, came to be rightly given to them?
That's reasonable.
Well, here's what I suspect. It seems to me that the earliest people around Greece believed only in those gods that many of the barbarians believe in even now: sun, moon, earth, stars, and heaven. Seeing all these always moving and running Theinta in their course, it was from this nature of running that they named them Theious, gods. And later, once they came to recognize all the other gods, they went on calling them by this same name. Does what I'm saying resemble the truth at all, or not?
It certainly does resemble it.
What should we examine after this?
Clearly spirits, daimons, and heroes and men.
And truly, Hermogenes, whatever might the name daimons mean, see what you think of what I'm about to say.
Just say it.
Do you know who Hesiod says the daimons are?
I don't recall.
Nor that he says the first race of men to come to be was the golden race.
That much I do know.
Well, he says of it, but when fate covered over this race, they are called sacred spirits beneath the earth, good, warders off of evil, guardians of mortal men.
What of it?
Because I think what he means by the golden race is not one made of gold, but one that was good and beautiful. My proof of this is that he says we are a race of iron.
True.
And don't you think he'd say that anyone good among people today belongs to that golden race?
That's reasonable.
And the good are nothing other than the wise, phronimal.
Wise, yes.
This then, more than anything, I think, is what he means by the daimons, that because they were wise, phronimoi, and knowing demons, he named them daimons. And in our own old language, this name actually comes out that way. So he speaks well, and so do many other poets, who say that when a good man dies, he holds great fortune and honor and becomes a spirit, in accordance with the title of wisdom. That's how I too hold that every man who is wise, demon, and good is something divine, daimonian, in life and in death, and is rightly called a daimon.
And I think, Socrates, I'm quite in agreement with you on this, but what would a hero be?
That's not too hard to work out. Their name has been slightly altered, revealing its birth from Eros, love.
What do you mean?
Don't you know that heroes are half gods?
What of it?
All of them surely were born from a god's love for a mortal woman, or a mortal man's for a goddess. If you look at this too according to the old Attic speech, you'll understand better. It will show you that, starting from the name of Eros from which the heroes were born, it's been slightly altered for the sake of the name. And either this is what heroes means, or else it means that they were wise and skilled speakers and clever in argument, being capable questioners, eroten, for Irene means to speak. So, as we were just saying in Attic speech, those called heroes turn out to be a kind of speakers and questioners, so that the heroic tribe turns out to be a race of orators and sophists. But that's not hard to grasp. What's harder is the question of men, why on earth they're called anthropoi. Can you say?
Where would I get that from, my good man? Even if I were able to find it, I wouldn't strain myself, since I think you're more likely to find it than I am.
You're putting your trust in Euthyphro's inspiration, it seems.
Clearly.
And you're right to trust it, since even now I seem to myself to have hit on something rather clever, and I run the risk, if I'm not careful, of becoming wiser than I ought to be this very day. Consider what I mean. First, we need to notice this about names. We often insert letters and remove others, changing what we mean to name, and we shift the accents too. Take dear to Zeus. To turn that phrase into a single name, we dropped one of the iotas straight away and pronounced the middle syllable with a grave accent instead of an acute one. In other cases, we do the opposite. We insert letters and pronounce what was low-pitched as high-pitched.
True.
Well, the word for human being has undergone one of these very changes, in my view. It's become a name out of a phrase, with the alpha dropped and the ending made grave.
How do you mean?
Like this. This name signifies that whereas the other animals neither examine nor reason about nor scrutinize anything they see, the human being, as soon as he has seen something, that's what has seen, means, scrutinizes and reasons about what he has seen. So it's from this alone that a human being was rightly named human, as one who scrutinizes what he has seen.
What comes after that? There's something I'd love to ask you.
Go ahead.
It seems to me there's something that follows naturally on these, soul and body, as we call the two parts of a human being.
Of course.
Let's try to analyze these two, the way we did the earlier ones.
You mean examine whether soul fits its name for a good reason, and then body after that?
Yes.
Well, to speak off the cuff, I think those who named the soul had something like this in mind, that it, whenever present in the body, is the cause of its living, supplying the power to breathe and cooling it, and as soon as this cooling agent gives out, the body perishes and comes to an end. That, I think, is why they called it soul. But if you like, wait a moment, I think I see something more persuasive to offer Euthyphro's circle. The explanation I just gave, I suspect, they'd look down on and consider crude. But consider this one, and see if it pleases you too.
Just say it.
What do you think holds and sustains the nature of the whole body, so that it lives and moves about, if not the soul?
Nothing else.
And what about the nature of everything else? Don't you believe Anaxagoras, that it's mind and soul that arrange and hold all things together?
I do.
Then this name would fit well for that power which sustains and holds nature. One might call it physis. It's also possible, more elegantly, to say psyche, soul.
Quite so, and I think this is more skillfully done than the other account.
And so it is, though it does look rather absurd as the name was actually formed.
Well, what shall we say comes next?
You mean the body?
Yes.
This one seems to me to admit of many accounts, if one twists it even slightly, a great many. Some say it is the sema, the tomb of the soul, on the ground that the soul is buried in it during this present life. And again, because it is by means of this that the soul signifies whatever it signifies, on this count too it's rightly called sema, a sign. But I think it's above all the followers of Orpheus who gave it this name, on the view that the soul is paying a penalty for whatever it is paying it for, and that it has this enclosure around it like a prison to keep it safe, an image of a jail being, then exactly what its name says, a soma, the body of the soul, until it has paid off what it owes, with not even a single letter needing to be changed.
I think that's been said adequately enough, Socrates. But as for the names of the gods, as you were just saying about Zeus, could we examine along the same lines by what kind of correctness their names are established?
Yes, indeed, Hermogenes, if we have any sense. There's one way, the finest one, that we know nothing about the gods, neither about themselves nor about the names by which they call themselves, whatever those may be, for clearly they call themselves by the true ones. The second way of correctness is the one prescribed by custom in our prayers, to call the gods by whatever names and titles please them to be called, since we know nothing else, for this seems to me to be a fine custom. So if you're willing, let's examine things having first told the gods that we won't be inquiring into them at all, since we don't claim to be capable of that, but into human beings, and what notion they had in mind when they gave the gods these names. That, at least, incurs no blame.
Well, Socrates, I think that's a fair way to put it. Let's proceed like that.
Shall we begin, then, with Hestia, as custom dictates?
That's only right.
What, then, would one say the namer had in mind in naming Hestia?
By Zeus, I don't think that's an easy one either.
In any case, my good Hermogenes, The first name givers run the risk of having been no ordinary people, but sky-gazing chatterers of a sort.
Why do you say that?
It appears to me that the giving of names is the work of people of just that kind, and if one examines foreign names too, one finds no less clearly what each one means. Take, for instance, what we call Ausia being. Some call it Esha, others Ausia. Now first, by the one of these names, it makes sense that the being of things should be called Hestia, and also because we ourselves say that what partakes of being is. By this too Hestia would rightly be the name, since it seems we too used to call being Esha in olden times. Further, one might come to this understanding by considering our sacrifices too. It's likely that those who name the being of all things Esha would be the ones to offer first sacrifice to Hestia before all the other gods. And those who instead say Ausia would probably hold in the manner of Heraclitus that all things are in motion and nothing stands still, so that the cause and the first principle of things is the pushing, whence it would be fitting for that to be named Ausia. Let this much be said on the matter, as coming from people who know nothing at all, and after Hestia it's proper to examine Rhea and Cronus, and yet we've already gone over the name of Cronus. Perhaps, though, I'm talking nonsense.
Why do you say that, Socrates?
My good man, I've just noticed a whole hive of wisdom.
What sort of thing is this?
It's quite absurd to say, and yet I think it has some plausibility.
What is it?
I seem to see Heraclitus uttering ancient bits of wisdom, exactly what applies to Cronus and Rhea, which Homer, too, was talking about.
How do you mean?
Heraclitus says somewhere that everything moves on and nothing stands still. And comparing existing things to the flow of a river, he says you could not step into the same river twice.
That's so.
Well then, do you think the one who set Rhea and Cronus as the ancestors of the other gods had any different notion from Heraclitus? Do you suppose it was by pure accident that he gave both of them names having to do with flowing? Just as Homer, too, says that ocean was the origin of the gods, and Tethys their mother, and Hesiod, I think, says the same. Orpheus, too, says somewhere that fair-flowing ocean was first to begin the marriage, he who took to wife his sister born of the same mother, Tethys. Consider, then, how these all agree with one another, and all tend toward the doctrine of Heraclitus.
I think you're on to something, Socrates, but the name Tethys, I can't make out what it means.
In fact, this name itself all but says outright that it is the disguised name of a spring. For what is filtered and strained is an image of a spring, and the name Tethys is put together out of both of these words.
That's clever, Socrates.
Of course it is, but what comes after this? We've dealt with Zeus.
Yes.
Then let's speak of his brothers, Poseidon and Pluto, and that other name by which they call him.
Very well.
Now it seems to me that Poseidon was named by the one who first gave the name because the nature of the sea checked him as he was walking and would not let him go further, but became like a bond upon his feet. So he named the god who rules over this power Poseidon as being a foot bond, Poseidesmon. The epsilon is inserted, perhaps, for the sake of elegance. Or perhaps that isn't what he meant, but rather two lambdas were originally said in place of the sigma, on the ground that the god knows many things, Pala, or maybe the shaking one is named from to shake, sane, with the pi and the delta then added on. As for Pluto's name, that was given with respect to the giving of wealth, Plautos, since wealth is sent up from below out of the earth. And Hades, most people, I think, take this name to mean the unseen, Aids, and being afraid of the name, they call him Pluto instead.
And how does it seem to you, Socrates?
In many ways, I think people have gone quite wrong about the power of this god, and fear him more than he deserves. They're afraid because once any of us has died, he remains there forever, and they're afraid too because the soul departs to him stripped naked of the body. But to my mind, all of this points to one and the same thing, both the god's office and his name.
How so?
I'll tell you what appears to me. Tell me, of all the bonds that hold any living creature in one place, which is the stronger, necessity or desire?
Desire is far stronger, Socrates.
Then don't you think Hades would lose a great many, if he did not bind those who go there with the strongest possible bond?
Clearly so.
So it must be some desire that binds them, if indeed it's the greatest of bonds that binds them, and not necessity.
So it appears.
And there are many desires, are there not?
Yes.
Then he must bind them with the greatest of all desires, if he means to hold them with the greatest bond.
Yes.
And is there any greater desire than this, when someone, in another's company, believes he will become a better man because of him?
By Zeus, none whatsoever, Socrates.
Then let's say, Hermogenes, that this is why no one down there has ever wanted to come back up, not even the sirens themselves, but they and everyone else have been utterly enchanted. So fine, it seems, are the words Hades knows how to speak. And to judge by this account, this god is a consummate sophist and a great benefactor to those in his company, one who sends up so many good things even to us up here. So abundant are the riches he has to spare down there. And it's from this, in fact, that he got the name Pluto. And this business of the soul being unwilling to keep company with people while they still have bodies, but only coming together with them, once it's been purified of all the evils and desires connected with the body. Doesn't that seem to you the mark of someone philosophical? Someone who has thought hard about the fact that this is the only way to hold people fast, by binding them with a desire for excellence, whereas if they still had the body's frenzy and madness on them, not even Cronos their father, for all his famous chains, could keep them bound to himself.
You may be onto something there, Socrates.
And as for the name Hades, Hermogenes, it is far from being named for the unseen, quite the opposite. It was given by the lawgiver from his knowing all things beautiful, and that is why he was called Hades.
All right, but what about Demeter and Hera and Apollo and Athena and Hephaestus and Ares and the rest of the gods? How do we account for them?
Demeter seems to be called Demeter, the mother who gives, because of her giving of food as a mother does. Hera is a kind of beloved. That's in fact why they say Zeus fell in love with her and took her as his wife. But perhaps the lawgiver, speaking of things up in the sky, called the air Hera, disguising it by putting the beginning at the end. You'd see it if you said the name Hera over and over. As for Pheraphata, many people are frightened of that name too, and of Apollo, out of sheer inexperience, it seems, with the correctness of names. They change it around and consider it as Persephone, and it strikes them as something dreadful, but really it signifies that the goddess is wise. Since all things are in motion, whatever grasps them and touches them, and is able to follow along with them would be wisdom. So Pheraphata would be the correct name for the goddess, on account of her wisdom and her touching of what is in motion, or something along those lines. And that is exactly why Hades, being wise himself, keeps company with her, because she is of that nature. But as things stand, people shy away from her real name, caring more for a pleasant-sounding word than for the truth, and so they call her Pheraphata. It's the same with Apollo, as I said. Many people are frightened of the god's name, as though it signified something dreadful. Haven't you noticed that?
I certainly have, and you're right.
Yet it is, in my opinion, a name most beautifully suited to the god's power.
How so?
I'll try to say how it looks to me. There could hardly be a name better fitted to be one, and yet touch all four of the god's powers at once, so as to take hold of them all and somehow signify music and prophecy and medicine and archery.
Go on then, You make the name sound like a strange thing indeed.
It is thoroughly harmonious, in fact, seeing that the god is a musician. First of all, purification and purifying rites, both in medicine and in prophecy, and the fumigations with medicinal drugs and with the sulfur used in divination, and the washings and sprinklings used in such rituals. All of these have one single aim, to render a person pure both in body and in soul. Isn't that so?
Certainly.
Then wouldn't the God who purifies, who washes away and releases people from such evils, be this very God?
Certainly.
So with respect to these releasings and washings, since he is a physician of such things, he would rightly be called Apolloan, the one who washes away. And with respect to prophecy and truth and simplicity, which are the same thing, he would most correctly be called, just as the Thessalians call him. For all Thessalians call this god Apollos, the simple one. And because he always has mastery over his shots, he is Eabalon, ever shooting. As for the musical side, we should understand it the way we understand Acalathos, companion, and Achates, bedmate, that the letter alpha often signifies together. And here it signifies the joint revolving, both in the heavens, where they call the poles homopile, and in the harmony found in song, which is called symphonia, sounding together, because all these things, as those clever about music and astronomy say, revolve together in a single harmony. And this god presides over that harmony, making all things revolve together, both among gods and among men. So just as we formed Acalathos and Achates from Homocluthos and Homocoides by changing homo to a, in the same way we formed Apollon from one who makes things revolve together, Homopollon, inserting an extra lambda, because otherwise it would have sounded the same as that harsh word for destruction. And that is exactly what some people now suspect, since they don't examine the power of the name correctly, and so they're afraid of it, taking it to signify some kind of destruction. But in truth, as I just said, it takes hold of all the god's powers at once, of the simple, the ever-shooting, the washing away, the revolving together. And the muses and music generally got their name, it seems, from Most High, to seek, and from inquiry and philosophy. Leto is named from the gentleness of the goddess, from her willingness to grant whatever one asks of her. Or perhaps it's as foreigners call her, many call her Letho, and it seems that name was given by those who use it to mark that her character is not harsh but tame and smooth. Artemis seems named for Artemis, sound and orderly, because of her desire for virginity. Or perhaps whoever named her called the goddess an inquirer into virtue, or perhaps because she hates the sowing of man in woman. For one or all of these reasons, whoever gave the goddess this name gave it to her.
And what about Dionysus and Aphrodite?
You're asking big questions, son of Hipponicus, but there is both a serious account of the names of these gods and a playful one. The serious one you'll have to ask someone else, but nothing stops us going through the playful one, since the gods too are fond of play. Dionysus might be, in play, Didonysos, the one who gives wine, and wine might most fittingly be called Oinous, since it makes most of those who drink it think they have sense when they don't. And as for Aphrodite, there's no point arguing with Hesiod. Let's just agree that she was called Aphrodite from her birth out of the sea foam, Aphras.
But surely you, an Athenian, won't forget Athena, Socrates, nor Hephaestus and Ares.
No, that wouldn't be likely.
No, indeed.
Well, one of her names isn't hard to explain.
Which one?
We call her Pallas, don't we?
Of course.
I think we'd be right to suppose this was given from the brandishing involved in weapons dancing. For we use the words palline and palestai, and orchine and orchestai, for lifting either oneself or something else up off the ground, or brandishing it in one's hands.
Quite so.
That accounts for Pallas, then.
And rightly so, but what about the other name? How do you explain that?
Athena's own name.
Yes.
That one is weightier, my friend. It seems the ancients thought of Athena the same way today's experts on Homer do. Most of these interpreters, explaining the poet, say that he made Athena stand for mind and thought, and the maker of names appears to have had something similar in mind about her. Indeed, he says something still grander, calling her, as it were, the mind of God, as though he were saying Hathianoa, using an alien alpha in place of eta, and dropping the iota and the sigma. Or perhaps that isn't it either, and he called her Theano because she understands divine things beyond all others. Nor is it out of the question that he wanted to call this goddess Ethano, as one whose understanding lies in character. And then either the name-giver himself, or others afterward, altered it, thinking to improve it, into Athena.